911, what's your emergency?
Baby, there's a shark on the freeway.
I love it.
I sing a lot more on this podcast than I was expecting to.
Well, I feel like as former theater kids, it had to be expected on some level.
Yeah. There are probably like a couple listeners who are like, please stop singing on the podcast.
I'm appreciating that you're bearing the brunt of it.
I'm sorry, you sing a lot on this podcast too. I edit these episodes too.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, as someone who's like working on a video where I like heavily talk about and like sometimes critique singing and like vocal performances, I definitely don't want anyone to have any ammunition to like throw it back and be like, well, you can't do any better, can you? Points invalidated.
People love to do that when you criticize music. They're like, well, have you recorded an entire pop album? And it's like, well, no, but like, is that really the bar to be able to have an opinion about one?
Right. It's like, if we call an episode bad on here, we don't have to go out and make an episode of 911 and
we
prove
should do
that
we can actually.
We should do that. I said it and then I realized we should
critique it.
We
or
should.
To prove that we actually... have no right to critique it. We should make a really
exactly.
bad episode of 911.
I was playing games today and I was listening to your video about your new one about the Lifetime husband movies.
Always be plugging.
And then like from like the recommended, it switched. I just had autoplay on, I don't know why, but it just switched to like an episode of Nexpo, like the horror YouTuber. He's also named Ryan, so that he and I have a really deep soul bond.
But I was
listening to it, and as he was describing this like harrowing tale of like someone getting lost in the wilderness, I was like thinking to myself, how would I turn this into an episode of 911? So who's on a school trip? Who has an emotional stake in this harrowing 911 call that takes up the bulk of the episode? How do I put Buck into a perilous situation?
Right. I think that's a common 911 watcher experience, is like either taking things from your real life and being like, how could this be a 911 scenario? Or noticing them in the other things you watch.
Yeah. Because like, there's always a way. There's always a way.
Now that I work in the deli, I'm always like, oh, I could totally just slice my hand off in the deli slicer or get locked in the walk-in or, you know, slip on something, accidentally
burn
myself
like that guy
on something.
That poor Rob Lowe did the chest compressions on.
Ooh. Well, 911 Prime had its own locked in the walk-in call.
What episode was that?
I think it's like season 4, maybe.
Season 4.
And they do it
like
set to Ice Ice Baby.
Yes, I remember now. I remember.
Of course.
I remember because I was watching with my roommates, and like the needle drop happened, and like we slowly started to piece together.
You're like, are you kidding me?
Are they actually doing this?
Well,
which is also a pretty common occurrence watching 911.
But guess what, guys? Given that it's the springtime and, you know, new life is popping up all around us, I can't relate because I'm in Minnesota and we just got a foot of snow last night. But today's episode is all about new beginnings. And in fact, it's called New Beginnings. Mm-hmm.
What better episode to talk about on the eve of the show's return?
Yeah, you guys, we are coming at you live. Well, not live. We are coming at you from the past, March 5th, 2025, meaning that tomorrow, for us, the new episode of 911 will air. By the time this airs, you guys will have seen the episode like a week and a half ago. So how was it? What did we all think?
Did they kiss? Was Buddy Cannon? What did we get? Buddy seeds? Did we get Buddy crumbs? Did we get pining? Did we get yearning? Did we get feelings, realizations? What happened,
I must
guys?
Say,
tell us all about
they
it.
They were being pretty forward with the episode stills they dropped for this one, and I don't know whether to believe that means there will actually be Buddy seeds in this episode, or if it'll just be like tragic queer baiting.
Yeah,
because they know what they're doing at this point, so it's kind of like, I think it'll be Buddy seeds. I'm relatively
Ryan
optimistic.
And Oliver are talking very openly about it in interviews, and I can just say I don't know anything about Tim Minear. There have been too many red flags with Ryan's interviews for me to take anything at face value. But Oliver, at the very least, seems like a man of principle. And
he
so
has, I think, actively said before that he's careful not to lead people on with stuff like this. So it does feel like, why would he be saying all this stuff? But watch this be like tragically ironic when this episode actually comes out and the episode has aired and it's like totally not about Buddy. I don't know. We're gonna eat our words one way or another.
Oh my god, are you ready for like another half season of clownery? Are you ready for another?
I'm ready.
Are you
ready, Ryan? I'm gonna be honest with you. I am ready.
Do you think Marisol's gonna come back? Do you?
Oh yeah, Eddie's gonna be married to a woman by the end of the season. Knowing this show.
Oh my god, a nuclear family. That's what it took to reunify the Diaz household. Getting a new Shannon.
We're gonna cut to him in Texas, and he's like, "Yeah, I met a girl, and we're married, and I have another baby now, and yeah, I've forgotten all about my friend Buck." That's like
and
the
Buck's
evil
just over there,
timeline.
Like a sad little puppy, like walking, like waltzing around, like traipsing around the gay bar, like feeling so out of
Buck
place.
Buck walks into the ocean and dies. Oops. Sorry,
oh my
guys.
God. Like sister, like brother. Wow.
Oh yeah. Okay. Not to make light of that. Damn. Well,
the Buckley family recipe for success.
Another funny thing, well, not funny per se, but a coincidence, I guess, is that tomorrow's episode of 911 is apparently about, or at least involves, a Maddie kidnapping. And, you know, spoilers, the episode we're about to discuss also ends with a Maddie kidnapping. So it does kind of feel like full circle moment.
Yeah. And not just Maddie. Other kids are napped.
Yeah, this is a kidnapping heavy episode, actually. So should we just get right into season 2, episode 11, New Beginnings, written by Tim Minear and Kristen Rydell, an iconic pairing?
An iconic duo. Oh, dare I say, a workplace power couple in terms
of
writership.
It's kind of amazing because I think this is a really like solid, kind of well-balanced classic episode of 911, like great balance.
Agreed.
Of like fun calls, real drama, real thrills, and dramatic, intense stuff. It's a good episode. Mm-hmm. And I feel like maybe this is what happens when you like marry the two showrunners, right? And get both of their strengths together.
Yeah.
So
you just
I
get the, like the best of both worlds with them. They just complement each other. Yeah. It's really nice. So we open on a little view of the Hollywood Hills opulence, and we have a Chopin needle drop. From Nocturnes, Opus 9, number 2, in E-flat minor, of course.
Wow, look at you.
I had to Google it because it was driving me insane. Because, like, I recognize the piece of music because I like to just listen to classical music, like, on playlists and stuff when I'm working, just, like, because it calms my brain. But, like, they didn't list it in the subtitles, and I couldn't find it on IMDb or on the fan wiki. So I literally, like, went to, like, all the composers that I knew, the classical composers. I was, like, looking at Bach. I was looking at Mozart and Beethoven. And then I went to, like, the Romantics. I was, like, Debussy. Tchaikovsky, and then I ended up on like a Chopin playlist, and there it was, and like
wow, so it wasn't like, even listed on IMDb. You literally just looked at every classical composer you could think of. That's kind of crazy.
I tried to Shazam it, and it didn't work.
Imagine
I literally Shazammed
that,
my computer.
Imagine doing that for like a pop song, like being like, "Huh, I wonder who did this song," and then just going like, "Okay, Katy Perry playing all of her top songs, Lady Gaga playing all of her top songs, Taylor Swift play like." I can't believe
like,
that.
At least it has like a very distinctive like opening like melody, like an opening little trill of notes. So I was able to like listen to like the first 4 seconds of each like, you know, movement or whatever, and just like move on to the next one. But like that is funny actually, thinking like in 100 years kids will be like like doing the same thing on whatever YouTube has turned into, being and like Doja Cat is like the new Chopin. Like Tate McRae is like the new Debussy. Addison Rae is on there somewhere.
She's Schubert.
Like, she's Schubert. Right?
Speaking of classical music, my sister is practicing the viola right now in my house. So hopefully it's faint enough that it won't show up on the recording. But if it does, maybe see if your editing software has a denoise effect.
Well, I mean, if she's good enough, then I feel like it would just enhance the episode.
She is so in a master's program, but it might not be the most pleasant thing for people to hear in the background of our 911 podcast.
Imagine we get your sister to live score our podcast.
Oh, she could probably do that.
With her viola. That'd be a fun little ooh, Patreon bonus episode.
Patreon
live
bonus.
Scored live by score. Jane's sister.
Yeah. Well, okay. We
oh my God.
Other than the than the classical music playing, the real subject mm-hmm. of this call is I think she's a divorcee about to be put under for plastic surgery. She's getting a facelift.
She's getting a little, if you will, a little nip tuck.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh. Ryan Murphy callback. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cinematic universe expands.
She wants to kind of find herself again by getting a facelift to look younger, which I don't really follow the logic there, but whatever. Mm-hmm. She's about to go under for a facelift. They put her under with the let me take that again. They put her under and she wakes up still on the operating table, and all of her surgeons are apparently unconscious or possibly dead. So we kind of zoom out and she has a flap of skin unattached falling down her neck, kind of a good gross out mm-hmm. gore effect. And
I just want to say
911 call.
I just want to say in Glee they got Britney fantasies and this woman got a nightmare. She got a halfway to an untimely Joan Rivers style death nightmare.
Well, they can't all be Britney fantasies. You know, they're trying to show the harsh realities of the plastic surgery industry.
But when she calls 911 and she said, "I counted backwards and now they're all dead." she's a Victorian girl, living out the Wells curse or something.
Or she's Eddie Diaz in that one episode of season 5. They're all dead.
They're dead. They're all dead.
Okay. Sorry, everybody.
The 118 responds, "They're all in hazmat gear.
Curious. Bright yellow hazmat suits.
Where the rest of the hazmat team is? Shouldn't there be specialists for this? Or maybe they just got hazmat training." It's I don't know. Yeah.
It's LA.
Yeah.
The 118 does everything. They respond to everything. I was watching this episode with my sister, and she was wouldn't people in this situation have a tool to measure, if they're to test the air, if there's a gas leak? And I was it's fine.
Maybe they couldn't get one, and they're just we'll make do with what we have. We have a deadline. We have 18 episodes to push out. Come on, people.
Right, right. You can only, maybe the LAFD is underfunded. But they show up in their hazmat suits because, this situation kind of makes it seem like there's some kind of a toxin in the air or a gas leak or something. So they get there. It turns out, the doctors are not all dead. They're just all knocked out. And they deduce that there must be maybe a leak in the anesthesia line, mm-hmm. That runs through the walls. Because all of these guys are just knocked out. It's not really seeming like a gas leak. And also the reason the girl getting plastic surgery is awake is that she's getting oxygen, I think. So
yeah,
she has
she's semi-intubated or something like that.
Yeah.
So she was revived. When they're first rolling up to the office, so they start speculating on what it could be because they don't know. And they don't have their little devices to measure the air. And so Chim suggests a gas leak, and Hen says, and I quote, "Could be some pathogen. World's a crazy place these days." And I was thinking, sweet summer child. It was probably the anesthesia line running through the walls,
right.
Which apparently is a thing. So this call, I was so in a moment of could this actually happen that I called my uncle, who is a professional anesthesiologist who's worked in the medical field for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately he was asleep, so I couldn't get any answers out of him. But my auntie
classic anesthesiologist. What
he
are
had
you
a migraine, he had a taking migraine.
Taking a little off the side, taking a little off the top.
But my auntie answered, and I asked her, I'm like, "Does this sound plausible? And she's like, "Well, okay, so listen. So, first of all, no." Because apparently, and this, she's not an anesthesiologist, she's a lawyer, but she said, first of all, from a legal perspective, I feel like that's just a lawsuit waiting to happen. I'm like, yep, mm-hmm. sure. And second off, apparently anesthesia machines, like proper like anesthetic, modern anesthetic machines that they were presumably using in this high-end plastic surgeon's office. I don't think the anesthesia, the gas, runs through the wall at all. I don't think there's a piping system involved. I think it's literally just a standalone machine that might be hooked up to something. But like, if there is anything connected to it, it's probably like a standard gas pipe or something like that. I don't know. I don't know enough about these machines. But what I gathered from our conversation and a brief Wikipedia search is that anesthetic machines are usually standalone devices that concoct the mixture that is anesthesia within itself that is then administered to the patient, and it administers it in, I believe, somewhat limited quantities. So anesthesiologists have to be very careful with how they administer it, and also because it can kill you if you use it
wrong. Have heard about that, like you have to kind of temper how much you're giving someone throughout a surgery. So yeah, the whole thing, they seem to have written it under the impression that anesthesia is like helium for balloons. And you've just got it like pumping in through a series of pipes, like, and there's just like a valve to turn it off and on.
Yeah, so already I'm out. Already I'm out. Like, this episode is done for me. Like,
wow. The Cinema Sins nitpicking on this show. But
the scene does not contain a lap dance. It does not contain a lap dance.
Oh, you're right. You're right. But it should have. I think Eddie should. No, but. But they decide to go looking for this purported leak. So they end up finding, we saw in the opening scene when the woman was still awake with her doctors, she was hearing some construction going on next door. Mm-hmm. It turns out, of course, these guys were like sawing into the wall and they hit this pipe and it sprung a leak. So Eddie seals up the leak, and they also have found two construction guys who are passed out. Oh, one of them has passed out right onto his circular saw, so that's a problem, you know. Got to get that sorted.
Jot that down.
And so, you know, they cart that guy out, and they're bringing out the plastic surgery lady. Speaking of which, during this call, she's also like had a flap of her forehead skin like fall down over her eyes, which I don't know if that's how that works, but you know, so really a horrific scene. But they're bringing her away, and you know, Hen says something like, you know, don't worry, you'll get your new face. And she's like, at this rate, I'll just be happy to have the old one back. And I guess maybe this is supposed to be sort of like a fable of like, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, it does seem like there's like an overarching theme of this episode is maybe like come to Jesus or something like that. Like a little perspective getting or something. I don't know. Maybe that's just like a character thing in general. But
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the theme of the episode is new beginnings.
That's true. That's true. Maybe she got her new beginning. Didn't even clock that. Wow. I'm slacking.
Or it's sort of like she was out for a new beginning, getting her facelift, and now maybe she's gotten a different sort of new beginning and having this life-threatening experience, which will make her kind of get a new lease on life.
Speaking of Jane, because, you know, we always stay plugging, and so I just have to ask you, because I just watched your Mark Wahlberg plane movie video, how are the prosthetics?
In this scene?
Yeah.
I thought they were much better than Mel Gibson's Flight Risk prosthetics. I thought they looked pretty good. You know, I love a schlocky practical effect in like a horror movie, and I think this show generally has good practical effects. I think if you're ever going to question the effects on an episode of 911, it's usually the CGI that they'll use that looks wonky. Yeah. I think their practical, you know, wound prosthetics always look really nice. So, shout out to whoever is in charge of that on this show.
We can just say it's all Tim Minear and Kristen Rydell.
They personally do it themselves. They're really dedicated.
We can give mom and dad all the credit. And dad get all the credit. I did have a gross out moment when that happened. I was like watching. I was like, ah!
Yeah, my sister was very shocked by all of this. But we go
Viola. It like stops playing like,
We go to the Grant household, where Bobby is setting down a beautiful bundt cake that he's apparently baked. And Michael and May get there, and apparently they're all stressed out preparing for Athena's parents' arrival at their house. Bobby's going to meet Athena's parents for the first time. You'll remember they just got engaged, so this is a big deal. You know, Athena shows up with her parents, and she kind of warns Bobby. She makes it sound like these people are maybe a little difficult. She says, you know, no matter what happens, they'll be gone in a few days or whatever.
And, of course, it's the meeting the in-laws for the first time, that tried and true scene of like a comedic gold mine. And of course, Beatrice and Samuel, the Carters.
Or a dramatic gold mine in the case of this episode.
A dramatic gold mine. The Carters walk in. I love calling them the Carters because it's like, oh my God. Is this what Beyonce and Jay-Z are going to be like in 30, 40, 50 years? But the Carters roll up, and they already don't like Bobby. Beatrice remarks that he's very tall.
They hate to see a quirked up white boy winning.
literally. And then she turns her ire back on her classic years-long nemesis, which is, of course, Michael Grant, and asks him how his husband's doing. Michael's like, well, Glenn and I aren't married, but he's good. And she's like, of course you're not married yet. You're barely even divorced. This woman is shady. This woman is shady. The whole episode. And so that just kind of sets the tone for their interactions going forward.
I will say, I looked up the actress who plays Athena's mom in this scene at one point, and I found out I think she's only like 12 years older than Angela Bassett. But you know
I hope
that is on Angela Bassett looking eternally youthful forever.
Yes.
We cut to a wonderful scene of Buck and Maddie are training in the boxing ring. Maddie is kind of trying to build up her self-defense skills, seemingly, because she's talking about getting this episode, she's kind of trying to finally get ahead of her Doug situation and, you know, stop having this feeling like she's running and really try and build up a way to defend herself and separate herself from the situation. So she is like hardcore. You know, Buck is holding those like hand. I don't know. We're not athletic people. At least I'm not. So I don't know what any of this stuff is called. But Buck's got like the hand punching thingies, not gloves. I know what those are called, but
like,
you know,
like
the ones
the hand
that you're supposed
guards, like the receiver guards or something like that. I don't know.
And
I don't know what they're called
the
either.
Gloves.
I'm not a boxer, but Maddie is, and she's hyping herself up.
Hands.
She's really feeling herself. You know, she's like, going, "I'm dispatcher of the month. I've got my own place. You're on my couch, okay?
Like,
I'm going with my life together."
Let me just say, Buck compliments her on quote her sassy new haircut. Crazy thing to have him say, in my opinion.
That he was LGBT from the word jump, I tell
you. I'm just like what kind of I was just watching it like, wow, famous heterosexual man thing to say. Congrats. Compliment
sassy
your sister
new haircut.
On her sassy new haircut. And, you know, to her credit, this Maddie is sporting a new sassy lob.
It is. She is sporting that new sassy lob.
You'll remember this is the mid-season premiere, so there's been a little gap in filming, presumably allowing her to get that haircut.
Yes, and it's interesting that you don't really get watching through a solid sense of like a time jump, but the episode definitely implies like a time jump. I feel like this happens with a lot of network TV, where they'll take their mid-season break, and then you're kind of expected to go in with that context of, we've been away as long as the characters have. So, like, I don't think watching this, you necessarily get the impression that it's been several months since, or even just several weeks since the last episode. But characters definitely do seem to allude to it in certain little one-off ways. And that's just like a funny little thing that I feel like you come up against in network TV a lot, is how to convey the passage of time. And I feel like that's like, you don't really get a solid sense of the passage of time on this show anyways. Like, do you watch season 8 and think, wow, Eddie's been at the 118 for like 7 years?
No, I do not. Yeah. So it is interesting how sort of, you know, between seasons, it's like time passes canonically and also like the status quo stays so static that it can be difficult to realize. But Buck says in this conversation.
It's honestly, if you think about it too much, like, it's kind of a harrowing depiction of adult life. Like,
yeah, like, just everything stays kind of the same. But, you know, Buck mentions in this conversation that he is still dating Allie, lest you forget, but she's, like, out of town right now. And Maddie kind of roasts him and is like, why is it that every girl you date either wants to flee the state or flee the country? Which, honestly, good question.
Yeah, but, classic sibling thing to ask. Just something really, like, deep and personal like that.
Yeah, very cutting, really. But Buck counters with, you know, when are you gonna finally start dating Chimney, essentially? Which, from there, we cut to Chimney is, like, at the pool hall, a thing that still exists. No, he's probably just at a bar. With one Jason Bailey.
One Jason Bailey, yes.
Guy who is not actually Jason Bailey and is actually Doug, the evil ex-husband. But Chimney doesn't know that yet.
As revealed by the cliffhanger twist of the last episode.
Right.
And Chimney's feeling, it seems like he's feeling a little bit frustrated that things with Maddie haven't progressed. And, like, obviously he's giving her time to sort things out. And, you know, they had that conversation, like, you know, when she's ready, like, he'll be there and all that stuff. But I don't know, like, if he's seeming like in a place where he's getting maybe a little bit antsy to take her out on a real proper sit down romantic date and just whiner and diner, you know?
Yeah, and he is unknowingly just feeding all this information to Maddie's abusive ex-husband. So that's, you know, disquieting.
Yeah, we get a strong sense of dramatic irony throughout this whole episode. That just keeps you feeling.
Yeah, I thought it was funny how they kept playing, like, evil music stings over Doug at certain points. It felt very Lifetime to me. Like, you know, they cut to him in this scene for the first time, and it's like, nah. And, you know, I think there's another moment like that towards the end of the scene, and it's just like, lest you forget that he's evil.
I feel like someone who's not familiar with your YouTube channel, like, tuning into this show, would think that maybe, like, you were a little too Lifetime-pilled, and that you always bring it back to that in some way.
Well, right, and I am Lifetime-pilled, to be clear.
But then, like, the more I watch your Lifetime videos, and the more that I, like fall down this rabbit hole with you, I'm just, like, every time you bring it up, I'm like, she's absolutely right. Everything comes back to the Lifetime movies.
There are a lot of references in Lifetime movies that you can apply to all walks of life. And time. and time. I have a Letterboxd listing all of the Lifetime movies I've watched. And guys, it's over 100 of them. So I'll never forget. I uploaded one of my Lifetime videos a while back, and I got this comment from somebody who was, like, really angry at me for, like, generalizing about the common Lifetime plots. And they kept commenting, like, she hasn't actually watched a lot of Lifetime movies because she's totally wrong about this. And I was like, girl, the one thing you cannot say about me is that I haven't watched a lot of Lifetime movies. You know, you can say whatever you want about the value of my opinions, but that is one thing you cannot say.
Oh my God. That is the one thing you cannot say. It's true. It's true. If there is a resident expert on Lifetime, I feel like they should honestly, like, pay you at this point. Just, like,
no,
have you on the payroll.
That would be fair. Yeah.
Because you've definitely
Who
put in
the time.
Who is giving
them more publicity than me?
You should at least be on, like, the PR, like, junket, like, be invited to red carpets and stuff.
That's
you know,
what
I feel like
I
that's
think.
Only
Do
equitable.
Do they even have red carpets for Lifetime movies, though?
I don't know. I feel like that'd be like having like a ceremony to celebrate the opening of a McDonald's or something. Like, no offense
Stop.
To Lifetime
was,
if they're listening.
That was so shady.
No offense. No offense, Lifetime. Nothing but respect for
you
and your craft.
That'd kind of be like having a birthday party for a fish, but.
Damn. Oh my God, my dogs are getting married. You should come. No, I don't want to.
We cut get to a girl and a mom driving on the highway. They're kind of arguing about the girl, what college the girl wants to go to. And, you know, anytime on 911, you randomly cut to characters you've never met before. It's like some fucked up shit's about to happen to these two.
Which is funny because, like, in this episode, it's totally a red herring for these two.
Yeah.
Because, like,
well, herring isn't really the type of fish that gets involved, but yes.
Shut up. But as they're arguing, you know, the daughter wants to go to University of Miami because she wants wide open spaces. Okay. And the mom wants her to go to a smaller school. She doesn't want her to be partying and doing drugs. And I just rewatched Euphoria with my roommate. So that was that I'm just like just vividly imagining all the ways this could go wrong for her. baby, there's a shark on the freeway.
There's something underneath my truck. Oh, a truck
seemingly filled to the brim with water.
Water and a
shark in it. Jackknifes. And like, you know, obviously spins out and traffic stops. And you think, oh shit, they're going to drown on land. But no, they get a 911 call. And it's somehow even weirder.
Sometimes I get my shark on the freeway. That's for all my VV Brown fans out there. Anyway, they call 911. They say, shark, a man's been attacked by a shark. And the dispatcher says, what beach are you on, ma'am? And she says, we're not on the beach. We're on the freeway, which I think is like one of the best 911 call exchanges in the entire show, if not the best. It's so perfect. So perfectly encapsulates the spirit of the 911 calls on this show. The burying the lead, the like comedy punchline. It's so great.
I mean, like, the punchline of this entire scene where they, I mean, we'll get to it, but when they have the shark strung up on the fire engine, like,
oh,
it's just like,
God.
it's the perfect 911 call.
It's
the perfect.
So funny. So the 118 gets to the shark on the freeway, and we have like a triple emergency here where like the truck has crashed, the shark is on the freeway, and in the process of like trying to pour water on it to keep it alive, one of the shark handlers has been bitten by the shark and actively has his arm stuck in the shark's mouth. So
poor Diego.
You know,
poor
comedy
Diego.
Of errors going on here. His name's Diego, the man, not the
he
shark.
He loves that shark. The shark is a woman, and he loves that shark. He's like pleading with them, please don't kill it. Please let her live. And Bobby, he wants to obviously get his arm free. So he yells, Jaws, and Chimney, he goes, right. Oh,
and
Jaws.
Goes, oh,
and
no.
Then they go
the
to get the Jaws.
Life.
Right, yes.
perfect call. They
perfect
get the jaws
call.
Of life. They pry open the jaws of the shark with the jaws of life. Inspired choice.
Inspired.
I do want to say Buck does have another moment in this scene where he is like raises like a pickaxe to kill said shark before the people have to be like, no, don't kill her. It's like this man has learned nothing.
Nothing at all. Character consistency. That's what we can expect from Buck Buckley throughout the next 8 years of this show.
They should have, because you know, in tomorrow's episode apparently there's going to be like a fire at an animal shelter. They should have Buck be like I'll get the dog out of here and just like raise his axe. They're like, no, don't do that. You can't just do that shit.
Oh god.
At this point he has like a problem with trying to murder animals on the job.
Oh wait, at least there's no more babies and walls for him to decimate. But
so far.
But they
need to get this shark into water if they want it to survive. And so Free Willy style, dare I say, they string up the shark in like some sort of rig suspended on the end of their fire truck and just wheel that thing out of there. Everyone clapped. The crowd goes wild. Everybody's like filming and cheering. It's amazing.
So I know that the fire hose they use on the trucks is extremely pressurized water, and like if you try to drink from it, it'll just like blast your face off.
Right.
But like they're pouring water onto the shark to keep it alive because, you know, it needs water to breathe. Sharks also need to be moving to breathe, so jot that down.
He's moving now that it's on the. I mean, she's moving now that she's strapped to a truck presumably.
But I figured they would have used the fire hose to, like, continually wet it as they were driving. Also,
Ryan, I'm
going to
hold your hand
question.
When I say this. I'm going to hold your hand when I say this. Fire hoses need to be attached to fire hydrants to have water in them. And kind of
what about
by
the,
definition...
What about water of, trucks? Some trucks have water in them.
Can't. Water trucks?
Yeah. No, when Buck... No, okay. Hold on. So you're telling me that in the pilot episode, when Buck sprayed that guy off of his motorcycle, he took the
Ooh,
time
okay.
to connect the valve to the fire hydrant?
No, I think he does.
No. No.
I think we need to look this up if there's a type of fire truck that already has a store of water in it. I think you need a fire hydrant. That's kind of why those exist.
Have water in them. Yes, fire trucks, specifically referred to as fire engines, okay, carry water in a dedicated tank.
Is this like a real result, though, or is it the AI overview?
That was the AI overview. Okay,
all
contemporary
right, bitch,
fire
do your
engines.
Real research
okay,
now.
Okay, SalonOhio.org. It said .org. It's the city of Salon, Ohio. Has to say contemporary
Salon,
fire engines.
Ohio, what a cunty little name for a town.
It is the cuntiest town in all of Ohio. Says that contemporary fire engines carry their own water, a pump to move the water, and hose. Water tank sizes can range from 500 to 1500 gallons.
Okay, I stand corrected.
Why do you think
I
it was so hard to lift the
wrong.
Truck off of Buck in
but,
oh
like,
we haven't gotten to that
they
yet.
Fill that shit up with water like every shift. I feel like that's so
yes
like that's why
they
fire...
clean it every shift too. That's why it's spotless. That's why it's immaculate.
I mean, I know they clean it every shift, but that's kind of a different job. We never see them filling up the trucks with water.
Okay, well, we never see them pissing and shitting either, but we can assume they do that.
to quote Sean Baker's Anora, touche. You got me. That's for all
touche.
My Anora heads out there. Listen,
congratulations, Anora heads. This
I
is for
saw
you.
Anora last night, and ever since, I have wanted to say, Anora, you're on the run now.
Oh my God. Anora, you're on the run now. You're out and
running
after
somebody.
Somebody.
I loved it. I don't care what the haters say. I didn't think it was sexist at all. I like. You know what? You know what I didn't like? The substance. It's Jane's hot take time. I did not like the substance.
Oh, no.
I
you
did
stop
like Anora,
that right
so
now.
So I guess
you
I have
stop
to, like, hang up.
Right now.
Yeah, I guess
don't
I have
start.
To, like, hang up
don't
my
start.
Feminist hat now because apparently I'm a bad one. Sorry, everybody.
I haven't seen Anora. I can't judge it, but you will not talk ill of the substance on this platform.
Well,
that
I just
movie
did,
was nominated
bitch.
For not just itself, but for all genre films at Best Picture. The first
it,
horror
listen,
film to be nominated
wasn't good
for
social
Best Picture since Get
and
Out.
It wasn't good as a genre film.
I just think you're wrong and
well,
I respect
maybe,
you
I
less for
you
saying that.
Okay.
I just like I don't know that I can continue doing this podcast honestly after this. Like I think
you
this
know
might
what?
Be the last
I,
one.
You have owed me one ever since the Sufjan Stevens thing. So this is me getting back for that. That's what I say.
You know what? Fair enough. I still don't like him, so I guess that can be, you know what? Substance can be your Sufjan. And
I
will
hate on anybody for
that.
Liking the substance. It seems like the vast majority of people like it. But I have to say, the more I mull over, like, why I didn't like it, the more I dislike it. Like, I went from kind of mildly disliking it to now I, like, have some active bitterness towards it, if you can't tell. But anyway, I mean, I did love, you know what I did love? Anora.
Anora. Anora. You're on the run now. Do you have any hot takes about Sean Baker that can be reduced to like a bitchy tweet that's designed
right.
to get 100,000 likes?
Oh yeah, I wish. I feel like that's for the haters, not for the appreciators. I have not seen a lot of Sean Baker movies, and I really don't have an opinion on his politics. It sounds like there's some weird stuff about like who he follows on Instagram, but I guess I just think the politics of his movies seem deeply curious and compassionate, and so I don't know if we can glean enough about his actual inner world and thoughts and opinions just from these, like, people he follows on Instagram, you know? That's my take on it.
But Jane, what about the dialogue? What about the dialogue where characters say and do problematic things? What about the fact that, like, every line of dialogue has to be a reflection of not just the writer and director's personal genuine 100% opinions about things, but also my own as a viewer.
Exactly. No, I do wish she had shaken her head disapprovingly every time she said the word faggot, just so that we would have known that she disagreed. But other than that, it was a perfect movie.
Best picture. Best picture.
Best picture. Well, you know, another bad bitch, this shark, is being transported.
Just like Anora, this shark.
You know who else was, you know, a woman who struggled and came out the other side? This shark. She is being transported to some sort of like pier, marina, something, and they just kind of, again, Free Willy style, lower this shark into the water. So, baby, there's a shark in
the water. There's a shark in the water. Buck and... is the shark's biggest fan.
Oh, yeah. Buck is like so invested in this, which is funny because like 1 second ago, he was ready to bust that shark's brain open with like a hammer.
And he's like crying and he's like, I wish Diego could see this. And they're like,
yeah,
he
like,
will.
Dude, why
and they're
on a
FaceTiming
first name basis
Diego
with the guy from the call all of a sudden.
I just think he loves like life and stuff like that. It's like the army thing. It's like with like the guy being reunited with his daughter. It's like, oh, he's just such a little sap.
Yeah, he does love just an emotional moment.
And we love him for that. But that's just like a little moment of why Bobby Nash is a much, much better captain than Gerard, because Gerard never would have done that. Gerard probably would have swung.
Gerard would have been like, take it out back
himself.
And shoot it in the head.
Literally, he would have been like, that shark needs to be punished. It was bad.
No, given what happened in Hen Begins, he probably would have been like, there's no guarantee we can save the shark. Just leave it to die.
You said that shark was female? You said that shark was female? We're not wasting resources on a
exactly.
woman shark. Do you know how much
money
the taxpayer loses
on saving female sharks every year?
At least $4. Then we cut from that back to the Grant household, and apparently Beatrice, a very type A mother, has reorganized the entire kitchen while both Bobby and Athena were at work, because she's just that kind of parent that feels very, very entitled to her child's home.
Right.
We've all met such a parent in our day, and we all have certainly some sort of immediate reaction to seeing such a thing on our screens with our characters that we love. I know I did. instantly did not like her.
We get sort of a little sequence of, you know, Harry has left some science project stuff on the table, and Athena is like, why don't you, Bobby, go tell him to move it? You know, you're going to have to become this stepdad role instead of just being his buddy. So Bobby goes over and he's like, nothing. He's like, he goes over there. He's like, please clean that up. Harry's like, I'll do it in a minute. He's like, no, I need you to do it now. And Athena's mom is like, who are you to be giving orders? You know, these aren't your children. This isn't your house. And then she like really goes in for the kill. She's like, I know that your family burnt up in a fire.
Oh,
she doesn't say it explicitly, but she's like, I know what happened to your family was tough, but you know, you don't get to just waltz in here and do all this. And
this one's
Athena,
not a consolation prize for your
you're
God,
like
Jesus.
Girl, why would you say that? Athena comes over and rightfully is like, you better apologize for saying that to my fiance. I love, first of all, I wrote in my notes, Angela Bassett should have actually won an Oscar for this show.
Yes.
If such a thing was possible. Because she's just so good. She's so good. She kind of gets into it with her mom. Her mom starts going off about all of Athena's decisions in life that the mom judges her for. And
I'm
going
to move to LA.
Line.
I'm going to drop out of law school.
I'm going to marry a gay man. I'm going to marry
a white
man.
I'm
going to
marry
a
white man.
It's like, boom, boom, boom.
Just wear her out. Just like get to like every little point on the list. Like, damn. Oh,
you're
my
like,
God, just,
man.
Like, leave nothing unsaid. It's just, like,
I loved
oh, my
it.
God.
I loved it.
It was, like, one of those, like, those interactions you watch on screen where like you feel awkward even watching it because you feel like you're in the living room. It's like, I should leave. I should. Can I go? Like, this has been great. I'm just gonna see myself out. Oh, I wonder what Eddie's up to. I'll just catch him. I'll catch you guys later. It's so frustrating for me with Beatrice because I was so on her side for a second, not because of anything she said to Athena, but because when she was on the couch talking with May, she was raving. She was raving about May's dress. She said it was a gorgeous dress, and this is why I said, hey, I told you so. I told you that was a gorgeous dress for her homecoming. Beatrice agrees with me.
I didn't think it was, like, ugly. I just thought it was sort of plain. It's not what I would have chosen.
It was simple and elegant.
I agree, but, you know.
But then we see what Beatrice's opinions are worth, because she lets Athena have it in a very uncalled-for way.
She said ACAB. She's homophobic. She's reverse racist. No.
You know what? I was on her side in the first half. You know, LA is cringe now, and all cops are bastards. But, you know... Then she started coming for me, and I was like, man, I wanted to be on your side so bad.
I just thought it was so funny that, I don't know, just that list of things was great.
The list of things that she had prepared to tell mm-hmm. her daughter in she the event that they got that. Into it. Oh, yeah. She needs to chill. Samuel, the dad, of course, is even over here like... you're kind of out of line. That's a little too far. Like, maybe dial it back, you know.
Maybe don't bring up his previous family that was burnt to a crisp in a terrible fire.
Yeah, like they literally have to usher like Harry and May out of the room while they talk about this. Beatrice says you should probably apologize to Athena, and she's so unwilling to like stoop down to that level of actually like owning up to the fact that she said some fucked up shit and maybe her daughter didn't deserve to hear all that, that instead of apologizing to her, she just says, we're gonna be out in the morning, we'll be gone by tomorrow. But then we sort of just leave Athena to sit on that as Maddie's at work at the dispatch being dispatcher of the month, of course. And she gets a call from, you know, a young teenage boy who is speaking in a very hushed tone. And he seems to be in some sort of, like, not necessarily life or death distress, but seems to be very, like, it's like one of those really, like, quiet calls of, like, hello, 911? No, it's my dad. He did something bad. And Maddie, you know, her spidey sense is tingling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, something's going wrong with this kid. In the suburban neighborhood, I have the address. But then who should crash the call but Dad?
Mm-hmm. And he's like, my son got in trouble and got grounded, and now he thinks he's going to call 911 about it. And you're like, definitely sounds like a normal situation and, you know, not suspicious at all. So Maddie hangs up, she naturally goes to Sue about it. And
the Sue Blevins advice column.
Of course, Sue is a real one about it. Maybe you should do a welfare check, like send a cop to go check on it. And then she says, like, you can trust your instincts, Maddie. You're coming into your own and you don't even know it. And it's like, yes, Sue, she's such a supportive boss.
Wonderful. I love their relationship. I really do. Mm-hmm. And of course, her instincts lead her to send the welfare check, as Sue suggested. And so Athena Grant is on the scene. She knocks on the door. And who should arrive to answer the door? But it's the seemingly strict dad who did something bad. And, you know, she's following up on the story. He seems to have a certain... sort of respect for procedure, so he allows her inside, tries to explain the situation away, and she asked to speak to the son sort of individually, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to fetch the son, and she starts poking around the house a little bit, just seeing, you know, if everything's all right, if there's any immediate signs of anything. And the kitchen is weirdly messy. There's just like a bit of a mess in the kitchen, in the sink specifically. It's covered in this like black dye. It's almost ink-like. And there's like a sponge or something like that. Before she can investigate further, you know, she goes to look in the trash, but before she can investigate further, the dad comes back, with the kid, and, it's just like, it's just a normal, like, you know, 13-year-old kid, but like, just, you can just tell by the way that he's stanced up next to his dad, how tense he is in his shoulders, the dour look on his face that, like, I mean, it's kind of clear. He's kind of terrified of this guy, mm-hmm. you know, absolutely terrified of him.
Yeah, naturally, and Athena wants to talk to him on his own. So she takes him out on the porch. The dad, like, very deliberately is like, I'll go empty the dishwasher. It's like, okay. She takes him out on the porch and just sort of chats to him about, like, you know, you're not in any trouble, but, you know, why did you call 911 and how are you feeling? And, you know, is there anything I should know about? And the kid kind of just says, like, no, I was just, like, angry at him and whatever. And the whole thing still has a suspicious vibe. But, you know, mm-hmm. I think Athena just doesn't really have anything obvious enough to go on to, like, yeah. take the dad away right now. So she kind of just, you know, leaves the kid with, like, her card, essentially.
She gives him some advice that kind of mirrors her own situation with her mom. Right. Which is, like, you know, things are, you know, things can be challenging, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. but like the kid like says something like along the lines of like, you have to tell my dad that everything's okay, you know, all that stuff. And it's like you can tell that there's something like you like immediately it's like there's something sinister going on under the surface. Like you get really bad vibes from this dad who just comes off as this like strict suburban dad or whatever. He comes out, ushers the kid back inside, and Athena is on her way. But instead of going back to the police station, she goes to dispatch and checks in with Maddie, right? Maddie recruits, of course, her beloved coworker, Terry.
Terry.
Everybody
Mowat.
Say, hey, Terry.
Hey, Terry. This is kind of one of those funny moments in this show and in like shows like this where they're listening to a call. They hear like a little blip on the audio and they're like, wait, go back. And it's like the enhance kind of thing where they're like, go back, like isolate that out in like a way that right. is like technologically impossible.
Yeah, he, it's like how manages... are you making more information in this recording?
Yeah, like... where there was none. But, you know, he manages to isolate this like sound in the background. And it sounds like the dad was talking to someone else. He says something like, you stay here, like I gotta go or something. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, there was a third person there, who was that? And you know, we cut back to the dad in the house and he like opens up the crawl space and there's another little kid in there like tied up. So it's like,
and like
oh,
dirty
okay.
and looks like he's been crying and it's yeah. like, oh okay.
It's kind of wild because, you know, when you hear the initial call and see the follow-up, you know, the naturally your mind goes to like, okay, this must be like a child abuse kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And then this happens and you're like, oh, this is like way crazier than what I thought.
Yeah, they did a really good job of like obscuring that sort of like thing of like burying the reality of the situation. It's like I feel like a lot of the times on the show, it's like so easy to like, they like very like clumsily telegraph what's actually happening on this call, and so the twist doesn't really take you by surprise. But there mm-hmm. is also just like a visceral like horror of like a guy opening up like a cellar and seeing this yeah. just this small
kidnapped
terrified child yeah. just bound and gagged and like yeah. seemingly like physically injured in some way.
It's very creepy. Like, this one felt is like one of those 911 storylines that's like them basically doing a Criminal Minds episode. They yeah. I like this one because it has a good balance of like, you know, they do some fun calls and then they also have this more intense like, you know, Criminal Minds-esque storyline towards the back of the episode. Whereas yeah. like mm-hmm. sometimes they do one where like the whole episode is kind of like that. And I always mm-hmm. find that kind of lame and boring. There was yeah. an episode like that in season 7 that I found particularly lackluster. But yeah,
I agree.
I think this mm-hmm. one has a good balance. The guy yeah. comes back to like the dining room and the other kid, you know, Stevie is there. And I think he's telling the new kid, he's like, calling him by a certain name, and the kid's like, that's not my name, like my name's whatever. So you can kind of deduce that both of these boys have been kidnapped by this guy, and he's like creating his perfect family or whatever.
Yeah. Again, oh my god, it's very so Lifetime. Creepy. Very Lifetime, very creepy, very SVU as well, I will say.
Yeah.
They do a lot of child kidnapping on that show, or at least they used to back in the show's heyday. And those episodes were always really fun because it's like, oh my god, these kids, they're in peril. And then it's like,
wow, Ryan Kern's quoted as saying, child kidnapping, ... really fun.
I'm sorry, it just makes for great drama, and I think this episode is a good example of that.
Right.
Sue me, sue me.
but get back from the commercial break, and Athena and her like detective buddy, which you know, friend. I meant friend, detective friend, are there staking out the house. Which I have something to say about the actor who plays this one detective.
Oh my god, like so do I.
Did we both see the same tweet? That revealing to us for the first time that, first of all, this actor is married to the actress that plays Eddie's mom, which is interesting, but also...
No.
Oh.
I didn't see that. What?
Well, that's fun fact number one. I saw this on 911 Twitter the other day. Fun fact number two, later in that Twitter thread, I found out this is the actor who played Fabrizio in Titanic. The little Italian guy.
What? Danny Nucci played Fabrizio?
Yeah, he's the guy who goes like... I can see the Statue of Liberty already.
Already. He's the one that gets crushed by the fucking pillar. Oh my god. Yeah. I didn't put that together. He looks so young in that movie.
No,
that's Fabrizio?
I never would have known, but I saw somebody online say that.
Oh my god. Oh my god, my king.
This is a cinema icon.
Yeah, so I love Danny Nucci because...
I'm sorry. Major missed opportunity not to feature him in the season 7 cruise ship disaster.
Period. Instead
what
of Tommy.
What were you thinking, 911?
But he had a sudden change of career or something. I don't know. Even just a cameo. But I know him. I know him because seeing him in a cop car next to Athena in a Southern California setting reminded me very strongly of a show in which he plays a lead character called The Fosters, which aired on Freeform, formerly ABC Family, in which he played a cop and the ex-husband of one of the lesbian moms, and he is a starring role, and he plays a very similar character in that show. Like, I was watching that, and I'm like, is that Mike Foster? Is that just Mike Foster again? Really? Wow, the crossover that we didn't even know. I thought they lived in San Diego, but I guess they're up in LA now. Who would have known?
Yeah, basically, this is a very famous actor in this scene.
So and a very handsome Athena, actor at that.
Yeah,
so jot
they're
that
staking
down.
Out. They're staking out the house, and they're watching the guy take out the trash. And I think they mentioned the hair dye at this point, right? The stuff that was in the sink.
Yeah.
Or is that later?
Yeah, that's later. You just see them staking out the trash.
You can just cut that out.
In the last scene, what's important to note is that they show a news story of a missing 6-year-old boy, and they show a photo. His name is Brian Gallagher. And he has blonde hair. And then you have this kid who has black hair who's named Noah. And he says, that's not my name. And then when the news story pops up and this kid has the same face as the kid in the scene and the dad says, Stevie, turn that off. You're like, oh, they dyed his hair.
Right. It's all
coming
together.
The sink was covered in like black dye or ink or something. Whoa. And so it's like setting this up. And so the detectives are going to get to work. We cut from that to Bobby and Hen. They're cleaning up at the fire station after dinner. And Bobby's talking about, you know, how sort of disturbed he was by sort of the way Beatrice spoke to Athena and interacted with her daughter. And Hen has this sort of like familiar like shaking of her head. She's like, yeah, that's moms and their daughters for you. She's like lists off all the kinds of type A moms there are. There's the fun moms and the tiger moms and the helicopter parents. And then there's, you know, there's the mean moms, the ones
kind of giving Bobby like this rundown of like, you know, you may not understand this, but like women and their mothers have like a specific like type of animosity sometimes, or, you know, have a specific type of relationship which I can't really relate to. I love my mommy.
But, like, I've definitely witnessed this. You know, I grew up with an older sister, and she and my mom fought all the time. So I totally, like, I even though I've never experienced this, I've definitely seen it. So, like, I can imagine what Hen's saying. And they make allusions to Beatrice's parenting style sort of being reflected in the way that she named Athena. Obviously, you know, the goddess of wisdom, but also the goddess of war. And also, what was the second thing Hen said?
She says, that was, like, and beside crafting, the point? But that's another and story. And you're like,
and
what?
Crafting. Does she knit? Does she? Athena had a major Minecraft phase after Harry got into it.
Of course.
She says, Hen says that for parents like Beatrice, you know, child rearing was less about raising a daughter and more about training a warrior, because she knew how hard it was to navigate the world as a woman, as a black woman. And so she was preparing her daughter in a very sort of like bootstrapsy kind of way. That was, that was presumably not fulfilling all of the emotional needs a child would want from a loving, stable, supportive parent. And Bobby, of course, is very disturbed and taken aback. by this.
But, you know, Hen encourages Bobby just not to get too in the middle of this situation between Athena and her mom, like that this is kind of their thing, and, you know, Bobby can only do so much, I guess.
Yeah, he doesn't want to get, you know, caught in the crossfire, as it were, while they're sparring. And it makes you wonder if, like, for Beatrice, these sorts of, like, spats that she has with Athena, these sorts of sparring matches, are kind of a way of testing Athena's wit or her resilience or something like that. I don't know. It's like one of those like thoughts of like, I wonder what her intention is when she is interacting with her daughter in this way.
Well, then we get an iconic and beautiful and sweet and amazing and cute moment where Maddie comes to the station to talk to Chimney, and she gives him divorce papers. Hear me out. She gives him divorce papers. And, you know, Chimney, of course, makes a joke. He's like, wow, this is so sudden. But Maddie, it's her divorce papers for Doug. She has decided to finally file for divorce. And Chimney is like, wow, this is a big step. Like, you know, he's going to be able to find you because, you know, you need to put, like, I guess your address and stuff on stuff like this. And she's like, I know, but, you know, I'll never really feel free of him until I am, like, legally free of him. So she knows that this is the next step for her in her journey. And also the next step in her journey, she's like, you know, you told me once that your calendar was wide open. Calendar callback.
Calendar callback.
She basically asks him out on a date, and he's like, of course my calendar. Well, he kind of jokes with her. He's like, no, I can't do Friday night. And then he's like, just kidding. And it's like, good one, Chimney.
Good one. Good one. And
but, you know, Maddie like kisses him on the cheek and then leaves. And he's so happy.
The rest of the squad is up watching this interaction, apparently. And as Maddie leaves, they start hooting and hollering. Eddie does like this faggoty little like Romeo and Juliet-esque gesture of like, oh, like Shakespeare professing your love.
It was quite a choice. That's okay. Don't ever accuse me of being too harsh on Ryan Guzman, because I think this was a genius choice on his part.
It was fabulous. But then it turns out that Chim actually did have plans on Friday, because as he's standing there, he immediately calls, Jack Bailey. I kept wanting to say Jonathan Bailey. I think you had that mistake last time. Now I'm saying it now. He had a date with Jonathan Bailey, and he had to call and cancel because, as he discloses to his friend, his new friend, they have this friendship, and he's so excited to tell his friend that Maddie, the girl he won't shut up about, asked him out finally. And
so
he is, of course,
inadvertently revealing his exact location and position to of him and Maddie to Doug. Like, he's telling him exactly where they'll be and exactly what time. So that's bad. But, you know, Chimney doesn't know.
And Jonathan Bailey gets an evil look in his eye. And then he gets to work.
And he starts going dancing through life, skimming the surface, and you're like, why are you singing?
But then we sort of cut from that back to, it's interesting how they balanced the Athena and Madney storylines with this sort of Athena Maddie detective work storyline.
Right.
Because I actually think that it's paced really well. Mm-hmm. But like saying, okay, then they went from that scene back to this scene, it makes me feel like, oh,
it's like back
we're back into this harrowing kidnapping storyline.
Well, yeah, it's kind of an interesting structure where like the first act and a half of the episode is like, you know, kooky 911 calls, and then we shift into this kidnapping thing, and that becomes like the whole plot of like the second to third act, which is interesting.
Yeah. But Danny Nucci found black hair dye in the trash.
He's like, I can see black lady's hair dye already. And, you know, both of them are puzzled by this because the dad is bald. I thought this was really funny because, right. Like, you know, we meet the dad and he's bald. And then at this point in the episode, we essentially learn that there was a plot reason for him to be bald. So that Athena and Fabrizio.
The only reason for a man to be bald. There needs to be a reason. Because otherwise, he might as well just have hair.
It's important to the plot. Otherwise, yeah. I'm going to be like, do you need to be bald, though?
Did Mark Wahlberg need to be bald in that plane movie?
I would say no. And you know what? I'm just going to real quick litigate this because I got some comments from like annoying people being like, you're stupid because he's obviously not wearing a bald cap. He said in interviews that he shaved his head. Like, why do you think that's a bald cap? It's obviously like 5 o'clock shadow on his head. And I'm just saying, first of all, I did acknowledge in the video that, you know, I had heard that he had given interviews where he said he shaved his head. But like what I'm saying is that it doesn't matter because it looked like a shitty bald cap. It ended up looking like an ugly, bad bald cap. So, like, that's what I'm saying. If he shaved his head, that was for nothing. He shouldn't have done that. It ended up looking the same.
How his wrinkly face, like, fades into his scalp. Mm-hmm. Like, why show that in glorious 4K HD, like, ultra HD, like, you know, like film, like why reveal that information to the public? We should all know less about each other.
Even if that wasn't a bald cap
and that was just a really misguided choice on the part of Wahlberg and director Mel Gibson,
iconic duo,
can't get over that.
Hate crime duo of the century.
It's like, it's just an insane choice. But also, like, to those commenters, I don't think you were wrong for looking at what looks like the worst bald cap in the history of film and saying, plainly, that looks like a bad bald cap. And I think they shouldn't have done that.
No, I agree.
It was, oh my God, I was like shocked when I saw it. I was like, ugh.
My take really is that I suspect that he really did shave it and then they also put like latex over it to try and smooth it out. That's my take. I think it's probably some combination of both. And that's another reason those comments bothered me is I'm like, it looked like latex. Like, that's what I said. Like, it looked like a bald cap. So I suspect there was some involved. I think it's kind of silly to just take for granted because Mark Wahlberg said in an interview that he shaved his head, that must mean that there was no other components to the prosthetic. But
famously, men have never lied. Famously, men in Hollywood have never lied. And also, I will say, taking the video as like a holistic unit, you know, like as just like one cohesive piece of art, right? You do mention in that entire first section, which is dedicated to the bad practical effects, that there is another scene where he's basically like ripping the skin off of his hand, and it looks really like gross and like gummy and bad.
Yeah, it's obviously
and, like, it's
just one
bad
singular layer of liquid latex.
And so I don't think it would be too far of a stretch to like see that and then look at Mark Wahlberg's weird head. Weird bald head that's in like 5 different shades of white, you know. And just assume that like if there's bad prosthetic work on one skin effect with that character in the movie, that there wouldn't also be a bad prosthetic effect on the same character in the same movie for his scalp.
Right. Like maybe they just broke out that bottle of liquid latex a second time.
Imagine being like that miserable that they'd jump on you about that. I'm sorry, I can't.
No, yeah, it was weird. But this has been your flight risk tangent of the video. Back to the episode.
We're actually making good time, so I feel like we do have time for a tangent.
I know, but I don't want to get so many tangents in here that then we stop making good time, you know? I'm really trying to bring us back to the days where we used to have episodes that were like an hour and 10 minutes, you know?
Oh my God. Remember those days?
I know there are probably some people who like longer episodes, but I guess I don't like our episodes to be like absurdly much longer than like an episode of 911, because I feel like it starts to get kind of ridiculous when you're covering an episode of TV and the episode recapping it is like way longer than the actual episode. But
yeah, it does start to feel like that like 13 hour response to like that 37 minute Jenny Nicholson video about why she didn't like Joker.
Right. We're never trying to channel that energy.
Right. But the detective found black hair dye in the trash, and this guy's bald, and so it didn't make sense. And then they find out that Stevie Parnell, the son, his real name is Daniel Walters. And they know that because they through the trash, they found his fingerprints, and they matched the fingerprints of a kidnapped child named Daniel Walters, who was kidnapped when he was the ripe young age of 6, the perfect kidnapping age. And so they extrapolate that that second person in there, you know, there might be another 6-year-old that was kidnapped. And so SWAT is on the scene.
Yeah, SWAT team out to storm the guy's house, but nobody's home. They don't find anybody there. Mm-hmm. So they start searching the place.
And it seems like it's not like the house was like abandoned in a hurry, and like they took what they could and like had to leave. Like everything is in place. It just looks like they stepped out for a bite to eat or something. They find, of course, the little nook where they kept the 6-year-old. I don't know why I'm saying they. The 13-year-old had nothing to do with it. Where the dad, the kidnapper, kept that 6-year-old boy. And so they start dusting for fingerprints. But Athena, she gets her intuition, her hunch. That you know, they're probably not fleeing the scene. Like we should probably actually vacate the premises in case they come back. And what should happen, of course, when Athena makes that call? Maddie at work, Sue Blevins comes up to her. We love Sue. Comes up to her and says, "Hey, Stevie Parnell's back on the line, and he wants to talk.
He's asking for you." Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Stevie has called Maddie back. Stevie is at a train station with little Brian, whatever his name is, and he tells her, you know, "I ran away with this other kid, and, you know, I know now that what my dad's doing is wrong. Like, I think something really bad is going on here. So I'm at this train station. I don't really know where I am, but, you know, I'm trying to escape." And so Maddie calls up Athena. She's like, "Hey, I got Stevie Parnell on the phone." This is where I wrote in my notes, "This feels like such a Criminal Minds plot." But you know,
it would have ended much more violently if it was on Criminal Minds. Let's be frank about that.
It probably would have been way darker. Yeah, there would have been all this, like, it would have gotten more into the dark kidnapping storyline. But at this train station, it's kind of just like this horror scenario where these kids are talking on the phone to Maddie. Suddenly the kid gets a ping on his phone. The bald dad has been, I don't know why we're even still calling him the dad, because he's not their dad.
He's just a guy. Kidnapper. He's Eric, right?
Oh yeah, Eric is his name. Bald kidnapper guy Eric is tracking the kid's phone, and he's tracked him
find
down.
Find my iPhone, right.
Yeah, find my, at this point I was like, I'm sorry, why would he even let the kid have a phone in the first place? Like, your kidnapping victim?
He has successfully gaslit and brainwashed the kid into thinking that he's his, but then also suddenly reintroduce this rogue element of second child that he, like, I don't know.
Did he think that the other son was not going to be weirded out by the arrival of another obviously kidnapped child?
Even the other son was weirded out.
Even he was weirded the fuck out. But yeah, so the bald guy shows up. I'm sorry, no offense to any bald listeners. I don't know.
Sorry, I'm so sorry to our bald listeners, by the way. If we
listen, we love you, our bald listeners.
We respect you. Hair loss is a very
community.
Yes, we do. We want to lick the top of your heads. Hair loss, male pattern baldness is a common distressor in many men's lives and a source of insecurity.
But you know,
so let's just say
the bald guy from Anora was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor.
Exactly.
And he came off very nicely in the movie. Well, yeah. At points he came off very nicely in the movie Anora. So you know, the bald guys can win.
Bald is
big,
beautiful.
That was a big win for the bald guy community, I imagine.
Bald is beautiful. Okay.
Bald is beautiful. You know who else was in an Oscar nominated movie this year? Stanley Tucci, another famous bald man.
Okay. And listen, we all love some Tucci. We all love some Tucci. You know, nothing to complain about with that. Also worked with Mark Wahlberg in The Lovely Bones. So jot that down.
You know, I think Mark Wahlberg should have played the serial killer in that movie. I think that would have been more true to life. The bald guy is shown back up at the train station. You know, he's closing in on the kids. He kind of grabs them, but Athena is now communicating with other cops in the area. It turns out they're nearby to this train station. So they've got the location. And so we see like two transit cops kind of take notice of the situation unfolding and start closing in on them.
They seem very lax about it. I will say they don't seem to be in any rush to rescue
the kids.
They start
like moseying on over there real slow.
Yeah, classic train station cops. They're first and foremost to ticket fare-evaders.
Yep.
Everything else is secondary. If this took place in New York, they probably wouldn't even go after the guy.
No, they'd be like, hey, I'm beating up a homeless person right now. I can't go over there.
And then Eric Adams is like, another $1 billion to the NYPD. They can get suppressors on their weapons or something. I don't fucking know.
So they can buy Teslas. Yeah. Well,
but the guy pulls out a fucking knife on the kids and holds it to like the little one's throat. It's like,
now he's
Jesus
fully
Christ.
Holding the kids hostage. And, you know, the dispatchers are all aware of this. They've got this hostage situation unfolding. Yeah. And
there's like no escape at this point.
There's no escape. Yeah. A train starts arriving, which at this point you're like, oh my God, am I about to see 911 do an episode where two children get pushed in front of an oncoming train?
I was thinking the same thing.
Luckily, the answer is no.
That would have been the Criminal Minds episode. That would have been the Criminal Minds ending to this.
Yeah. Luckily, the answer is no. Instead, something way more iconic happens. The train pulls up and, you know, this guy thinks he's gotten away. He thinks he's just going to get on the train and get out of here. Who should be standing there when the train doors open but Athena Grant? With her snappy one-liner. She's got her gun pointed at him, and she says, "This right here is your stop," which I thought felt kind of spiritually Vivica A. Fox Wrong series tagline of hers. Like, it felt like, you know, similar energy of the big title drop that Vivica A. Fox usually does.
I agree. I think they both excel at the really big snappy one-liners.
Looks like you picked the wrong train.
I will say I did appreciate the implications of this scene, because not only did Athena catch the train perfectly in time, but she also picked the exact car and door to stop at.
Yeah.
And it seems with her weapon drawn, she was able to maintain perfect like balance and like equilibrium on the moving train as it was stopping, which, as any New Yorker will tell you, it's easy to fall over.
It would have been really funny if she like started to deliver her line and then like as the train kind of jerks to a halt, she just like eats shit.
Like, oh, shit.
Falls down on the ground.
I need to
be holding on to like at least two different handrails to keep my footing when I'm on a stopping train or bus.
And so they get the guy. Ladies and gentlemen, they got him. And the kids are taken back to the police station. They're returned to their custody of their parents. The young kid, you know, he's only been kidnapped for, you know, what seems like maybe a couple days or like a week or something like that. And so the parents are very like, you know, emotional. They're like still in like the adrenaline high of like, we need to find our kid. And they find him, and it's very like weepy and touching. It's like what you'd expect of like this kind of reunion. But then the older kid, I mean, like, he hasn't seen his parents since he was six. He had like recurring dreams about his mom and his house, but like he was gaslit by Eric.
He seemingly kind of lost his memory of his childhood, like because of the trauma of being kidnapped and sort of this guy's gaslighting and brainwashing on him. So he really believed that that guy was his dad, and had only really had memories of his previous life through dreams.
But he has this sense memory of tugging on his mom's hair and her laughing and everything, and like her hair is curly. And
It's very moving.
It's very moving, and it actually I got genuinely really emotional watching this.
And Athena ends up having this talk with him because, you know, his parents are on their way, and he's sort of feeling weird about it. You know, he's afraid of like, you know, I barely know these people really, and I've changed so much. Presumably, and our relationship is just going to be totally weird and this new thing to navigate. And Athena kind of gives him this talk about, I don't remember exactly what she says, but she's kind of tying it back again to her own parental stuff.
You know, at one point she says, like, you know, you have the rest of your life ahead of you with lots of new experiences, and this
can be
your new beginning.
Hey.
He could even, through this reunion, find a new direction for his life. Maybe he should join the Glee Club. I don't know.
Maybe he should join the Glee Club to work through his trauma. That might be effective.
It does seem to work out for the rest of the kids.
But Stevie's parents do show up, and his mom does have curly hair, which is like the one thing he remembered about her. And, you know, we see in sort of the montage, he does tug on her hair again, and she's like, oh, they're both having, they do remember
the way I cried. The way I cried.
I cried a little bit too. And I love, there's this shot of Athena just like nodding approvingly in the background in a way I thought was really funny.
We go from that back to Athena coming home, the Grant household, you know, Athena's parents, the Carters. Mm-hmm. Are still here. They're making dinner. Someone's on the grill, and they invite her over to the table. She says she needs a minute. She goes into her room, locks up her gun. Good gun safety, I guess.
Yeah.
And mom comes in for presumably, you know, one hopes for a real heart to heart. where they can, you know, sort of resolve some of their conflict and sort of like with this new perspective that I guess she's gotten, being kind of outside herself on these calls and sort of like seeing a lot of herself in this kid, or maybe like seeing.
I think throughout the whole episode, we're seeing Athena kind of access her parental side and be very protective of these children. And so I think it's sort of her healing her inner child in a way by sort of, you know, enacting, modeling the behavior that maybe she wishes she had had from her mother. That's what I perceived it as being, especially, you know, in that final scene when she rescues the kids. She's like really hugging them and saying like, you're safe now, I've got you. And I think I think the point there was it was supposed to be like she's kind of accessing her own power as a loving parent to kind of, you know, pay it forward instead of allowing her trauma to, you know, continuing that cycle.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that. I like that reading of it. Mom comes in and, you know, she talks about Tanya Kingston. You know, she saw Athena on the news and all she could think about was those guys searching for Tanya. Obviously, the very formative moment of her childhood.
The girl next door who got kidnapped when Athena was a child.
She's thinking about their household growing up and the sort of protectiveness that she feels over her daughter and the concern she has for her well-being. And it felt like, you know, the minute Athena turned 18 and sort of became an adult, she felt like she was running away from her, sort of running away from their family to start off her new life. And it felt like she couldn't wait to get as far away from her home and her childhood as possible. And I think, like, you know, it's implied that that was very hurtful and difficult for her mother. But Athena, you know, she tries to provide some context in that she certainly never intended it that way. She never felt like she was running away from home. She felt like she was running towards the rest of her life. You know, her mom had spent her childhood preparing her for the world, and what was she going to do with all that preparation if not go out into the world and find her place in it.
Yeah, and her mom has this interesting line kind of closing out this scene. It doesn't really end on a nice resolved note. The mom line where she says, you know, I worry the next time your life falls apart, I won't be there to put it back together. And it's like, damn, you're just like preying on my downfall. it's interesting also because it sounds like foreshadowing, right? But maybe I'm misremembering something, but I don't feel like this. I don't think there's like a big moment in this season where like Athena's life falls apart.
I don't think so either.
Could argue there are moments maybe later in the show where things get worse, like in her marriage or in her life, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so. I don't really know why her mom said that other than just to be awful.
The parental, I guess, hypervigilance and sort of like the entitlement to her daughter's life, like, you know, that's palpable in this sort of scene. And like, I feel like it does do a good job of balancing, you know, both perspectives here, because you do get a real sense of concern and for Athena's safety and her happiness from Beatrice. But you also see very strongly from Athena's perspective how misguided that concern is and how hurtful the ways that manifests, you know, when she talks to Athena like this in this very condescending way that she does, this almost controlling way that she does, where it feels like she's almost controlling the outcome of Athena's life.
Mm-hmm. And it's also tough because, like, knowing Athena, like, she really has lived a very successful life from like an outside perspective. You know, we don't love that she's a cop, but objectively she has become very successful in her career. You know, she's raised these two great kids. She you know, had her marriage end in kind of an unexpected way, but now she's found love again, and she still has a good relationship with her first husband. It's like she's really built this from the outside very impressive life. So it kind of,
she's like doing everything right, in a sense.
You can imagine her anguish probably at like never that not being good enough for her mom, like even though she has been successful in so many ways, it's still not good enough.
Because her mom still sees her as, you know, the little girl in her room, you know, tucked in her bed while the whole neighborhood's out looking for the next door neighbor, you know, and thinking, well, that could be my daughter, you know.
There is something very like, I was enjoying just the drama of this storyline in this episode, because there is, you know, it just feels like grounded, it feels interesting, it feels like it's getting at all of these things that are good character stuff for Athena.
And I really love in these shows, whether it's like a network show or whatever, when you see these established adult characters get almost reduced back to being someone's child, you know, and having to deal with their parents. Because I feel like, especially like as, you know, we, you know, become settled into our adult lives, we've definitely experienced what it's like to feel like a complete adult person and have a conversation with a parent that turns sour. And then suddenly you're feeling like you're a teenager trapped at home again, you know, with your parents controlling your life. It's a very human thing.
Some of us more literally than others, based on our life circumstances, but
Yes. Well, from there,
our final scene. It does hit. Our final scene, also very dramatic. We have Maddie at home. My sister and I both remarked on this again. This one has a very Lifetime look to the visuals. Like, she's in her dark house walking down her big staircase. That's a very Lifetime kind of shot. She gets a call from, I think, her lawyer, right?
Yeah, Donna.
She gets a call from Donna. That Donna makes me think of Mamma Mia, personally.
Right.
And Donna is saying, you know, she served these divorce papers, but nobody knows where Doug is. No one's seen him in months. He's not, you know, where they used to live. And what does she say that, like, who did Doug, like, rough up? One of Maddie's...
Lori.
Boss?
Yeah, it was her old boss. We saw on the first call, you know, Lori wasn't answering her phone. The office was a mess, and then Doug was there. And so it's like, oh, no, he did beat the shit out of Lori. She's fine. She survived. Doug is confirmed.
Doug is on the loose.
And he's feeling punchy, right?
Yeah. So, you know, she gets that call, very ominous. And then simultaneously, we see Chimney outside arriving, like, with flowers for their date. He's all dressed up. He looks great. He's, like, walking down the big hallway of Maddie's, the exterior of her house. This is what I was saying in that other episode of, like, her house seeming really big. But, you know, he's walking down. And again, very Lifetime, we see this figure in, like, a black hoodie and black gloves. This is happens in every Lifetime movie. And it's Doug. He's following Chimney. And he catches up with Chimney. And, oh my God, he just stabs Chimney.
Just stabs him. Just fucking, like, stabs him right in the abdomen several times.
It's
and
very
leaves
violent.
Him bleeding
it's very
in
sudden.
The courtyard.
Oh, yeah. You're mm-hmm. this. I would have been so gagged if I watched this live in 2018, 2019.
Literally. Oh, my God. As someone who was there.
Maddie is still in the house and she hears someone come in. She like turns around to be like, Chimney, you're never going to believe this. And it's Doug. It's Doug in the black hoodie with his black gloves serving Lifetime villain. And
And he decks her right in the face.
Oh my God,
fucking,
he just punches
her. He fucking wears her out, dude, and then it cuts to black.
Oof.
Oh my God.
This is a hell of a mid-season premiere.
No kidding.
We left the mid-season finale on a big cliffhanger, and now we're leaving this on even a bigger cliffhanger. You know, Chimney might be dead for all we know. Maddie
season two
might be
is
dead
so
for
beefy.
All we know.
Season two is such a beefy season.
Oh my God. There's so much going on.
Imagine having this kind of energy in. I hope, honestly, tomorrow we'll see the return, the season 8B premiere. And if it has this kind of energy, listen, I'm on board. Not Maddie getting punched in the face, obviously, but like.
Shark on the freeway, big cliffhanger.
Yeah. Like, you know, just like this very bombastic, like, stuffed episode. And
can I just say, I saw like a new promo for the new episode the other day, and I thought it was kind of funny because it shows all this footage from like previous seasons. It's got like the earthquake, the tsunami, the B-NATO, and it's like, you've seen them conquer all of this. And then it says, but this time it gets personal, which is already a hilarious line to use because that has been a joke of a tagline since, I think, Jaws the Revenge. So that's funny. But anyway, they say this time it gets personal, and they show Maddie getting kidnapped. And I just thought, first of all, as if this is like the first storyline on this show where it's quote unquote gotten personal. But also, that's kind of extra rich knowing that this isn't even their first Maddie kidnapping storyline.
on the spring premiere, even. I mean,
exactly. I just felt kind of like this is disingenuous. If I had two nickels, you know, like this is kind of silly that we're acting like this is the most dramatic thing they've ever done. Like, this isn't even the first time you've done this.
I mean, I guess it just wasn't personal
when Doug beat and kidnapped Maddie. Impersonal thing to have happen to you,
because you know what, he looked at the camera and he said, you know what, Maddie, for all of our ups and downs, it's not personal.
I don't want you to take this personally, Maddie.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I do love the absolute super villain like levels, like depths of like blood psychopath, like they reveal Doug to be like operating on. You see him and you hear about him, and like there is like generally a sort of reluctance, especially in like network shows when they're dealing with topics like intimate partner violence, to not show the abuse too graphically or too savagely, because like I feel like everyone with tact and with humanity kind of knows that it's kind of distasteful to show a man savagely beating his wife, just like like to the full extent of like how it sometimes unfortunately happens in the real world. There is a strange level of honesty in just how like the brutality of the Doug Maddie scenes, because like, you know, for as harrowing as it is to watch and for as unpleasant as it is, I mean, there are a lot of Dougs in the world, and they have done even worse things than he has.
Right. It's not even like larger than life to have him like have tracked down and like kidnapped or tried to kill her. It's like you hear about that happening all the time in domestic violence situations. So, you know, I think it's I do think it's funny that I brought up Lifetime so many times because I distinctly remember thinking that the episode, not the one after this, because the next one is Chimney Begins, but the one after that, where we see kind of the Doug and Maddie evil road trip. That's probably a bad way to put it, but you know what I mean. And the final showdown between them.
Yo, the best way to describe Lolita, the fucking Humbert evil road trip saga.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you guys.
Oh, that's amazing.
But then also the culmination of that storyline, it always felt Lifetime to me, but not in a bad way. It was just like, it didn't feel Lifetime because it felt like low budget or cheesy or whatever. It felt Lifetime because this story of like a woman getting, you know, engaged in this showdown with an evil person and then like having to get that revenge and like fight to the death with them out in the woods, like feels very I've seen that play out in Lifetime movies before, but I think it's very well executed nonetheless.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like, I appreciate the honesty of it. And it was honestly, it was jarring. I was jarred. I wasn't disgusted. But I was taken aback by, how they just like went right for, I mean, excuse the terminology, but went right for the punch.
I was kind of surprised that they had him do that instead of, I don't know, I would think the more like TV, once again, Lifetime kind of thing would have him like sneak up behind her and like, you know, he's got chloroform on a rag or whatever and then knocks her out. But I mean, I guess they had to have her face him so that she could recognize him and then he has to knock her out. But there is, it's definitely jarring to have him just punch her in the face. Yeah. But I mean, again, like, he's her evil, you know, that is Doug. That is what
he does. That's Doug. Yeah, that's the Doug. That's what he does. And I mean, listen, if they're gonna tell the story, they might as well tell the story. So, and with that, it cuts to black, and that's the episode.
Yeah, bleak ending. You know, it's the emotional highs and lows in this episode is pretty wild. It's wild that we went from the exuberant shark on the freeway Free Willy scene to this. Yeah.
The epic
just
highs
like
and lows.
43 minutes
of 9-1-1 season lows. 2. Episode 11, New Beginnings, are rivaled only by those of High School Football. And I'm glad we had this time to talk about it.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good ep. I mean, we already said Shark on the Freeway will forever be iconic to me. I'm so glad we got to this one. And I'm excited for our next episode, which is Chimney Begins. I think that's a great one. We obviously had like a weird, like slow burn of realizing that we didn't like Hen Begins that much while talking about the episode. But I think we describe in that episode how the Begins episodes kind of get better, you know, that the Hen one was unfortunately kind of a prototypical episode. And then with Chimney, they become a little more interesting. So I'm hoping that this will be maybe a more, a better one for us to talk about.
Yeah, I concur. I think, you know, the way that the fandom has embraced Chimney Begins as like, sort of like the pinnacle of the Begins saga, if you will, along with, you know, Bobby Begins Again, I think is a really popular one. Both season 2 episodes, I think. Yeah. And I'm excited to see it because we're getting up to the point that I resumed my rewatch of my watch through the show when I was getting back into it because I stopped at the episode after the Maddie Doug showdown. I watched that episode and then I broke up with the guy I was dating, so I stopped watching the show. And so I picked back up on that episode and then I watched through there. So I haven't seen any of these for the first time. So Chimney Begins is going to be really fresh.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was just thinking while watching this episode that we're really getting to a point where I feel like I just watched these episodes, like in my rewatch I did for my video, you know?
Yeah.
I was watching season 2, season 3 as recently as like less than a year ago to prepare for my video. You know, I was watching, I watched the new episodes that came out in like, what, March? And then I watched through the season, and then I started my rewatch probably after that season finished, season 7. So really, like, just as recently as this summer, I was watching these episodes. So that's kind of wild. I'm like, you know, and some of these things I used in my video, like the shark on the freeway thing, I used heavily in my video. So I was just, I almost have that scene memorized, you know?
This was your brat summer, essentially. We're coming up on your brat summer.
Oh, yeah.
Love. I'm excited to see it. So with that, guys, enjoy the new episode. Tell us, buddy, this is gonna be fun. Thanks, guys, for listening. See you next week, partner.
Partner, sharkner.
Yeah.
What do we think of that one?
I like sharkner. I like it. We'll keep it.
All right.